I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There's some good news on the animal welfare front. The euthanasia of cats and dogs is down dramatically in recent years because more people are adopting rescues and shelter animals, some at brand-name stores that have severed ties with puppy mills. McDonald's, Costco, Walmart, and other big-name food companies now have cage-free and gestation crate-free policies. Ringling Brothers is ending its elephant acts, and SeaWorld is ending its orca breeding program. Researchers are moving away from animal testing for drugs and cosmetics. Even Hollywood is getting in on the act, relying more on CGI than real animals in movies where they could get hurt. Our guest Wayne Pacelli documents all of this in his new book called The Humane Economy, how innovators and enlightened consumers are transforming the lives of animals. He is the president and chief executive officer of the Humane Society of the United States and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
So glad to be with you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So you can make money and help animals. Is that the message of today?
You know, it used to be that people talked about animal protection. If you really wanted to adhere to these ideas, it would be a sacrifice. Profits would be sacrificed. You'd be inconvenienced. Now the world has changed dramatically. And I think it's a tremendous drag on business to have animal cruelty baked into the business model. If you do, you're going to be subject to lawsuits, to protests, to boycotts, to, you know, your brand being defamed. When you build animal protection as a core value of the company, on the other hand, because we now have this mass of consumers who are alert to the needs of animals, who recognize that animal cruelty is a moral problem, they will reward companies doing the right thing. So we really have these twin forces of kind of moral intention combined with innovation and human creativity and ingenuity that are giving us new options in this day and age. You know, when Lewis and Clark were traversing the country, you know, in 1803, they were wearing fur coats, right? Because they didn't
keep warm.
Yeah, they had to keep warm. It was a matter of survival. There were no department stores. There was no place to get these, you know, warming clothes except from the animal kingdom. Now it's different. We don't need fur coats because we have developed alternatives to fur that are just as stylish, just as warm, and that victimize no animals in the process. And I think that is true for so many other sectors of the economy. A lot of people don't realize that animals are everywhere in our world.
Well, and I'm also thinking all of that, I think, is very important and certainly has been a big influence. But I'm also thinking of those undercover videos. And I know the Humane Society has been involved in some of them where you go into a slaughterhouse or you go into a puppy mill place and you see the conditions that animals are in. And, you know, it's horrifying. Or you see Cecil the Lion, for instance, and you think, holy mackerel, what is going on here?
There's a big disconnect between what we believe and what happens in the real world. All of us who are part of a civil society believe that cruelty to animals is wrong. But so much of it is so distant from our daily experience. If, you know, it's no longer the days of an agrarian culture where we were kind of slaughtering the animals right in front of us or right on our farm. Now the puppy mills are 100 miles away. The slaughterhouses may be 1,000 miles away. The activities on a movie set, you know, maybe 3,000 miles away, maybe produced in some, you know, foreign country. So I think what's happening, Marty, and you've put your finger on it, is that we now in the information age have opportunities to access what's really happening. And of course, the Humane Society of the United States and other animal welfare groups are throwing back the curtain with our own undercover investigations. But of course, journalists are playing a big role in exposing these issues. And of course, social media and just the rise of, you know, our smartphones that allow us to record information, to take pictures. I mean, we see big changes in all parts of our society as a consequence of these changes in information distribution.
And I'm thinking about elephants in particular. I mean, what we have learned about elephants and how they live in communities, almost families, what happens if one of them gets hurt or dies, how they respond to that. And some of what we're learning from researchers who were out in the field who were saying, look at this.
A scientific awakening precedes a moral awakening. You know, it used to be that we thought animals were just operating by instinct, that they were somehow these biological, mechanistic creatures that were in this endless kind of food gathering, mating. They didn't have choices. They didn't think. Now we know from Jane Goodall, who did her amazing work in the 1960s, starting in the 1960s in Tanzania, to just a cascade of other researchers who are telling us about the lives and the cognition of animals. And as you talk about the family lives of these elephants, I mean, they live in these maternal, you know, family groups, the grandparents and the mothers and the babies are all there. They're long-lived animals. They can live 60 or 70 years. You know, we now see rituals of, you know, burial rituals and funeral-type rituals in the chimpanzee community, in the elephant community. Mm-hmm. So if we are alert to these issues and the incredible thinking that these animals exhibit, how can we then not consider our behavior, you know, shooting them for trophies, killing them for their ivory? I mean, how wasteful. And then you see the other side of it, the fact that now millions of people go to African countries as a form of wildlife-based tourism and generate billions of dollars in commercial activity, creating jobs that allows people to be fed and educated and women getting out of the home and getting employed. This is transformational from an economic perspective. So it's not just the moral argument that elephants should be protected, which for me and so many others is sufficient to warrant protection-oriented activities. But when you layer over the economic opportunity given by our love of animals, the fact that we humans are bonded and connected to other creatures, you can monetize that.
We did a show, like a lot of people, on Cecil the Lion, and frankly, some people criticize us saying, what, you care more about lions than you do about the people in that part of Africa that are struggling with their own lives? And I'm even thinking about we're learning about the slavery associated with shrimp fishing in the Far East. I mean, that's a whole other issue, but it is, I'm not saying we've made enormous progress on this, but it is interesting that maybe it's easier to care about a lion than it is to care about complicated people. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think that there are plenty of cases, and it's the right instinct where we're concerned about humans, you know, being hurt. It's not as if the whole world is just animal protection.
Right.
We have a pluralistic society, and fortunately, there are lots of people who care about lots of issues. And the fact that so many of us do kind of have an emphasis in different areas, the whole adds up to a civil society. When the Cecil the Lion killing happened, it was right and proper for us to be outraged. I mean, this is a beautiful creature just trying to live his life in a wonderful national park in Zimbabwe, and some guy lures him out of the park using part of an elephant carcass to draw him out and then shoots him with an arrow. Using his wealth, he's a dentist from Minnesota, using his wealth not to help the animals of Africa, not to help the people of Africa, not to do something good for his community, but selfishly wanting to put a trophy on the wall. People were outraged, and one reason why I talk about it in my book is in the wake of the Cecil controversy, all the outrage, 45 airlines, all of the big U.S. carriers, United, Delta, American, and global airlines all over the world said, we're not going to carry trophies of African lions or elephants, rhinos, leopards, or Cape buffalo. It was the humane economy forming right in front of us that when a problem came to light, business, driven by consumer sentiment, responded and changed the way our world operates for the better, helping animals. And this is really kind of the beauty of what I'm seeing from my perch as president of the Humane Society of the U.S., that the world is changing for the better on animals. We still have so many problems, and by no means am I taking a victory lap here. But we are making progress, and I think that should encourage all of us who care about building a civil society.
Well, I was talking to you just before going on the air, having seen ads for SeaWorld in the last couple of months, basically telling viewers, we're taking care of animals, we love these animals, no animals are being harmed, so to speak. And I have to say, I said to you, I'll say it on the air, I was kind of suspicious. And then doing some digging, I saw you and the head of SeaWorld basically coming together saying, we're going to stop this breeding program and turn a page on what animal acts involved in SeaWorld.
Yes. And, you know, we've been critics of SeaWorld for more than 25 years. So it's not like we just criticize to then endlessly criticize. Criticism is supposed to precede a solution or some sort of agreement. So no one's been tougher on SeaWorld than me and the Humane Society of the U.S., but the real inflection point on this issue, the turning point, was a wonderful movie director named Gabriella Cowperthwaite, who did Blackfish, which, you know, had its theatrical release, and then CNN purchased it and then started to broadcast it serially on CNN. I mean, it was just coming. The ratings were amazing, which is why CNN kept running it over and over again. And that tells us about the appetite that Americans have to learn about these problems. SeaWorld stock went from the mid-40s down to 17. I mean, the street just reacted to this. Their attendance dropped significantly. This was a company in crisis. So there was a new leader who came in because of that crisis. A congressman whom I knew introduced me to this man, Joel Manby. And we had 3 months of kind of quiet discussions about this. And we came to a set of terms that I was comfortable then publicly celebrating with Joel Manby and SeaWorld, which is an end to all orca breeding at all of its facilities in the U.S. and abroad. No orcas ever at new facilities that they might develop. The end of the theatrical shows with orcas, putting millions more into rescue and rehabilitation of stranded marine animals, so using the SeaWorld facilities to do good. It joining with the Humane Society of the U.S. in our campaigns against commercial whaling, commercial sealing in Canada, and shark finning throughout the world, where they kill the sharks and they cut their
fins. For soup, right?
For shark fin soup. They cut the fins off and throw the rest of the carcass back in the water. And then also, which was important to me, they changed their food policies at all of their parks. So they've got food concessions and food service for 22 million people plus 20,000 employees. And they're going to do cage-free eggs, crate-free pork, more plant-based options, sustainable seafood. So this was a pretty comprehensive agreement. And we want companies who were doing, in our view, not the right thing, we want them to move in our direction. That's the point of our work at the Humane Society.
About a minute before our first break here, what happens to those orcas that have been bred in captivity then?
24 or 25 of the 29 orcas that have been bred in captivity, so almost impossible to think about releasing them to the wild.
You couldn't do that?
Couldn't do that. You could potentially do sea pens, as they're called, where you have an inlet and you have an enclosed area. SeaWorld doesn't like that idea. Some animal advocates do like it. We've committed to studying the issue more carefully. Mm-hmm. We do have skin in the game on that issue. We put $1 million into a sea pen for Keiko, who was rescued from a Mexican aquarium many years ago and kind of became the animal as part of the Free Willy films that you may remember.
Sure.
So he lived for several years. We considered it a success. SeaWorld didn't. But the key thing now is no more orcas coming into their parks through reproduction, and certainly no animals captured from the wild. And that's part of our agreement.
And that's Wayne Pacelli, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's the president, CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. He's the author of a new book. It's called The Humane Economy, Animal Protection 2.0, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We want your stories, your reaction, your comments. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Rain. Excuse me. I almost forgot who I was and where I was. This is Radio Times here at WHYY. I'm Marty Moskowain talking with Wayne Pacelli. I should add he'll be at the Free Library of Philadelphia just a little bit after noon today, running over after this program is over, obviously joining us on Radio Times. And he's got a new book called The Humane Economy, Animal Protection 2.0. And we are walking through many of the chapters in this book, looking at some progress when it comes to the treatment of animals, animal welfare. And again, we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Now, Pennsylvania's had the dubious distinction of being called the puppy mill capital of the East Coast. How true is that today? We've done a number of programs on that very topic over the years.
It is still true. There's been progress, no question. And, of course, last week, Philadelphia City Councilman Kenyatta Johnson led an effort in the Philadelphia City Council to stop the sale of puppies at pet stores in Philadelphia as a way to kind of choke off the market and stop the puppy mills from, you know, having a sales channel. And more than 130 major municipalities and locales across the country have adopted similar provisions, which is really a sign of our growing public disgust for puppy mills. Former Governor Ed Rendell led an effort on this issue, and lawmakers passed legislation. It was a tough fight to have stricter standards. A number of mills shut down, but there are still hundreds of them in the state of Pennsylvania. And, you know, it's really, for a lot of folks, it's part of the agricultural economy. You know, some of the folks who used to be involved in pig production or chicken production, they set up an operation and have puppies. And the issue for us, Marty, on this is that the dogs are treated like, you know, these animals on factory farms, that the mother dogs have it the worst. They're typically in a cage. They don't really get out of the cage. No one is socializing them. No one's playing with them. They're bred every heat cycle. They're outside, so they're exposed to extremes of heat and cold. And we all know how hot and cold it gets during a calendar year. And they're denied veterinary care. It's all about just reducing costs and maximizing the profits on the dogs. And it's an agricultural production model applied to companion animals. And this is at the same time that our shelters here in Philadelphia, in the suburbs, the county suburbs, all throughout the state, also in New Jersey, are struggling to adopt homeless animals. We've got 3,500 brick-and-mortar shelters. We've got 13,000 animal rescue groups in this country desperately trying to adopt homeless animals, eliminate the euthanasia problem. I write in the book that in the mid-70s, there were 15 to 20 million healthy and adoptable dogs and cats euthanized in the mid-70s. Now it's down to about 2.5 million. So an incredible drop, which, again, is a marker of progress, but we're still not there. And the puppy mills are kind of churning out puppies that are clogging the supply chain for those people who want to bring a dog into their lives.
It seems to me, I think you write this in the book, that there are a couple of these sort of brand name pet stores that sell supplies, that they have, no puppy mill animals? And,
yes.
And are they able to absolutely determined that that is indeed true?
Well, I do mention it in the book, and thank you for reading it so closely. The two big chains in the pet supply area are PetSmart and Petco, dominant in the field. In fact, I write in The Humane Economy that in 2014, the biggest private equity deal in the world of all the companies in the world was PetSmart being purchased by a private equity group from London. And so when you think of all the private equity deals, mining and energy, pet supply store was the biggest thing. So that shows that our world is very connected to pets. But in the mid-1990s, PetSmart and Petco stopped procuring dogs from breeders, and specifically the mills, headquartered, you know, centered in Missouri and Oklahoma, but also Pennsylvania. And they threw open their doors instead to rescue groups. So now if you go to a PetSmart or a Petco on an adoption day, the store will have a lot of homeless animals who are primped up and look great and are ready for a loving home. And through PetSmart and Petco, they've adopted out 11 million dogs and cats in this period of time. So this is transformational. And now we've got a number of other pet stores like Pet Plus in this area that are now forswearing the puppy mill procurement strategy and also working with rescue groups. So one thing I note is that someone who goes into a PetSmart or a Petco and adopts a dog, they spend five times more in the store than the average customer. They get this high from getting a new companion.
Because you got to get the blanket and the,
yeah, exactly,
and the collar and all the chew toys.
Exactly. So it's good business. That's the point. It's not that this was a sacrifice for Petco and PetSmart. They get a halo effect in general. They get more traffic in the stores. People spend more. It's a winning strategy from an economic perspective, which is part of my thesis that if we rid our nation of the puppy mills, we're going to have better economic outcomes. Yes, there are going to be some people who have decreased profits who are exploiting the animals, but others who are involved in helping save animals are going to make more. And that's what Petco and PetSmart have shown us.
And it's also, we've done shows about this as well, what's been called the Underground Railroad, you know, of and these tend to be women, but I'm sure there are men involved as well, just individuals who are taking animals out of kill shelters in the South and transporting them up the East Coast. My son got one, you know, a dog that way. And while it's interesting to think about these big stores, it's also, I think, important to remember what people are doing on the sort of ground level.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's different because years ago we just had a community like Philadelphia. If the dogs were going to be saved, it was people in Philly, and that was it. Now we're seeing that we have an uneven situation around the country, that in the Northeast, there's much less euthanasia than ever. In some states, there are no animals euthanized at all. But in the South, you do still have high rates of euthanasia. So there are intrepid and wonderful folks who are going down and they are pulling animals from those shelters and bringing them up here to New Jersey, to Pennsylvania, to Connecticut, New Hampshire, and saving lives. And this is another positive development, and it's part of this information age that exists.
Is the humane economy, does that include vegetarianism or veganism? Is it anti-meat?
It is definitely focused on food and agriculture. I wouldn't say it's just vegetarian and vegan. I do talk about in the book that there are entrepreneurs, companies like Hampton Creek based in Silicon Valley, a company called Beyond Meat based in Los Angeles, that are mining the world's plants and finding the best plants and then fabricating plant-based proteins that mimic the qualities of chicken and beef and pork. So you can, Marty, you could get a
You've
piece of chicken. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because you're a vegetarian.
I've been a vegan for
a
long time.
Right.
So you can get, and you've got, you know, one of the best restaurants in the United States here called Veg, which is, I mean, it's not one of the best restaurants, period, not just vegan restaurants. But these companies that are fabricating plant-based proteins, we can now mimic the taste and texture of meat. We can have equal or superior nutrition, but none of the moral problems of factory farming and inhumane transport or inhumane slaughter. And there are so many products, not just in Whole Foods or Trader Joe's, but also in Kroger and Safeway and Walmart and Target. And this is going to increase. We're going to get better. It's just like computing, right? The initial computers were a little bit slow. They were cumbersome, and they're just getting faster and faster and better. That's what's happening in the world of food technology and agriculture. Mm-hmm. And I talk about in the book also, I met with folks who are doing cell culture meat. They are growing meat in a laboratory. Now, we already do cell cultures for organ development. We do it to produce products for insulin. It is not fanciful or absurdly futuristic to think we can grow meat in a laboratory. And you're growing the meat without the bones. You're growing it without the heart, without the brain. So you have all of the characteristics of meat because it is animal tissue, which is what we eat when we consume meat, but without any of the moral problems associated with it, without the waste. You know, Francis Moore-LePay 40 years ago called animals protein factories in reverse. They require all sorts of inputs of plant matter to produce a small amount of animal flesh. So it's 12 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef, 7 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of pork. We have we produce so much waste as human beings. Our waste is treated. The 9 billion animals raised for food, they produce huge volumes of waste. None of it's treated. It pollutes our streams. It putrefies the air. There are so many externalities associated with factory farming and industrial animal production. We've got to think about our diet. Now, it doesn't mean you have to be a vegetarian or vegan. I've chosen that. That's the right choice for me. But just reducing your consumption. If we reduced our consumption by 15% of animal products, we would save 1 billion animals a year. 1 billion, just 15%. One day a week, we go meatless.
Well, but and that also tells you how much meat people are still eating.
The average American eats 30 animals a year. So we have 320 million people in the United States. We raise 9 billion animals. Now, the global figure is we have 7 billion people, and we have 77 billion animals raised for food. So it's 1 to 10. If the rest of the world adopts our diet, I mean, forget about the environment. I mean, we will be in serious, serious trouble. We are already stretching the capacity of this planet to raise and produce these grains to feed animals who inefficiently convert that plant matter into animal protein. And we have all the grazing, we have all the waste, we have overuse of antibiotics, we have hormones. I mean, I could go on about this.
I'm still trying to get my head around 30 animals, not, you know, like 30 pounds of animals.
30,
like 30 animals.
It's 200 pounds of meat a year per person, 220 pounds of meat, 30 animals. Most of them are chickens. And, you know, the fact is these animals, we don't want to think about it often, but they have their lives. They are important to them. They have the same will to live that we do. But culturally, you know, we've placed animals in certain boxes. You know, these are our companion animals, and we want to protect them. But, of course, it's not pure because we still have puppy mills and dog fighting and other problems. But then these animals raised for food, we think, oh, it's okay. Well, they have their lives. And we now have options. You know, when I became a vegan in the mid-1980s, the vegetarian-type products, I mean, obviously you had all the vegetable foods.
I remember those days.
Well, yes. I mean, we have all these vegetables, which are great for us, but then in terms of, you know, soy milk and those things have gotten so much better. We have almond milk, we have soy milk, we have, you know, burgers of every variety. It's so much easier today than ever before.
That is Wayne Pacelli, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, head of the Humane Society of the United States. He's got a new book. It's called The Humane Economy, subtitled Animal Protection 2.0, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. And we are walking through various chapters in this book and also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Got lots of emails, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just read an email from Jamie. I've been telling myself for years that the geese and ducks who give us their down have also been used for their meat and their carcasses are not wasted. Could you clarify so I know whether or not I can feel good about my down bedding and jackets?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really drilling down into a specific issue, but it's a good thought. I mean, these products are not humanely obtained. For the most part, and it's not just a byproduct. I mean, just like fur, animals are not raising bobcats. I mean, we are not raising bobcats and beavers for their meat, and then we're harvesting the fur. It's the other way around. The purpose of the enterprise is to get the outer garment. There is some duck eating and goose eating, but it's pretty minimal. And it has not been a focus of the Humane Society, but it's an important question. And I think the key point is we now do have options in all of these areas. You have animal-free outer garments. And you know, when you think about it, my God, you know, the people who go in the coldest climates, people who go at the coldest time of the year to trek to the North Pole or the South Pole, they don't go in fur. They typically don't go in down. They go in synthetic products that are incredible at keeping us warm in the most inclement conditions in the world.
Email from Stephanie who says, I saw a horrific video over the weekend of dogs being slaughtered in an Asian country for their meat and for their hides. The narrator reminded us that every belt, handbag, watch, band, etc. That are manufactured in these countries come at a huge cost of animal suffering. What can be done about this?
Well, this is a big focus of the Humane Society. It's actually the big issue there is dogs being raised for their meat and being consumed. South Korea is the only country in the world that raises dogs for meat. And Marty, I it's hard for me even to tell you. 17,000 dog farms in South Korea. 17,000. I mean, it is a big industry. And we have been working with South Korean officials and working with these farmers to convert them to plant-based agriculture and other forms of agriculture. And we've been rescuing dogs and bringing them back. We're just bringing animals to New Jersey, and we're bringing them all over the United States. This is a big issue, but I think the world is changing. It's not just a Western movement. There are advocates in China. There are advocates for animals in South Korea, and we are helping them, but they are there, and they are fighting on these issues just like we are. And I'm convinced our goal there is to end the dog meat trade in South Korea by the time they have the Winter Olympics in 2018. The world spotlight will be focused. This is a shameful practice. And young people don't want to eat the meat of these dogs. And pet keeping is hugely on the rise there. So they're going to face a real cultural clash. And I hope we win in that clash and people realize that this is a terrible enterprise to be involved with.
I remember reading an expose a year or so ago about no animals were harmed in the filming of this movie. I mean, we've all seen that. If you go to the movies and it turns out that some animals were harmed, as it turns out, depending on what they were asked to do. I just saw The Jungle Book over the weekend, and not a real animal to be found in that film, although they sure look real. How much do you think CGI is just changing the world of Hollywood?
I'm so glad you mentioned it. Incredible. This is a revolution. You know, I talk about in my chapter on entertainment in the book, some of the history of the use of animals in film. And there are many, many ugly incidents for many big-name films that so many of us have seen. But it's hidden. They're not going to put that in the final cut. And that's the problem, the backstory. And so many animal issues, there's a backstory that we do not know about. Now, I talked to Darren Aronofsky. He's done beautiful movies. He did Black Swan. He did The Wrestler. Yeah. But he also did Noah. And there's no movie that has a higher degree of difficulty in representing animals than Noah, because you need two of everything. And Darren realized in my interview with him, he said, listen, I could go to these animal acting places and I could get a camel and I could get goats and I could even get some wild animals. But it's a barnyard full of animals. I need to represent all the animals. Computer-generated imagery was the solution. So what he was able to do was eliminate any harm to animals, because animals don't just act on cue. I mean, there are forcible training techniques when they do act. But he was also able to keep the animals at the center of the story. Part of the human story is with animals. We don't want to omit animals from the human story. And, of course, the Jungle Book, they're at the center of it right there. We're the sidelight to that story. And now we have a new technology that can allow us to get past this. I talked to the folks who wrote the Planet of the Apes movies, Dawn and Rise of Planet of the Apes, two separate movies. You know, representing these highly intelligent chimpanzees and gorillas, were they going to bring animal actors? You know, with chimps, they have raised them, and then they use them until they're 7 or 8, but then they get too powerful. Right. And then they dump them on our community, and then we have to care for them. Chimps can live 60 years. So we have chimps at our Black Beauty Ranch. There are several other facilities. Why do we bear the financial burden for the 50 years that these animals survive after they're done with using these chimps in advertisements, these silly Super Bowl commercials where they have little baby chimps, you know, doing funny things dressed in a costume? Of course it's cute. But it's not about just about being cute. It's about what happens to these animals and what happens to the animal welfare community. Why do we have to spend tens of millions of dollars cleaning up other people's problems? So whether it's the movie industry or whether it's the advertising industry using these animals, we can now get past it because we have CGI technology to have a better representation.
Wayne Pacelli is our guest in this hour of Radio Times, head of the Humane Society of the United States, author of a new book called The Humane Economy. We've got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Wayne Pacelli. And when he's done with us, he is motoring on over to the Free Library of Philadelphia, where he will be talking about his new book called The Humane Economy. Let me get Rebecca from Langhorne to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rebecca. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was just wondering, I used to think about the Humane Society as being, you know, really focused on pets, like cats and dogs at my local shelter and so on. And I just wondered if it was recently or fairly recently that kind of the oversight extended so much into, you know, animals raised for food and so on. And, you know, I wondered if that also has trickled down to kind of all levels of the organization, you know, is thinking about what we eat, you know, on the minds of volunteers at, you know, my local shelter.
Sure. So. Yeah, thanks, Rebecca.
Thank you for the question. I've been CEO for nearly 12 years, and I think there's a general misperception about the Humane Society of the United States that it is just dogs and cats. That's certainly part of our birthright. We do a huge amount for dogs and cats. We've always done a lot for them. But the founders of the organization in 1954 imagined a national organization that could fight the biggest fights for all animals. I think what I've done maybe is just put my foot on the pedal even more to focus on food and agriculture issues and the wide range of issues. But we're doing more on companion animals than ever. In fact, we've got an amazing program here in Philadelphia called Pets for Life. So we go to zip codes where people are at or below the poverty line. And the folks in these communities love their animals. It's just that they have pet care deserts in their communities. There are no vets. There are no animal care operations that they can go to. And some of these folks, as much as they love the animals, don't have the money to get vet care and spay and neuter and some of the basics for their animals. So we have community organizers that knock on doors and say, listen, on Saturday at the park around the corner, we're going to give you free dog food. We're going to give you collars and leashes. We're going to give you a voucher and we'll transport you to Spain to Republic. We have helped thousands and thousands of animals and thousands of people. And that is really important companion animal work. We do this in rural areas. We also have an animal rescue team that raids puppy mills and dog fights. So internationally, we're doing street dog work. We're fighting the dog meat trade. So I want to be real clear. We are big into dogs and cats, second to no one. But we're all animals. You know, whether there's animal testing or whether it's animals in food and agriculture, wildlife, horse slaughter, horse soaring, we are advocates for all of them.
Rebecca, thanks for the call to Radio Times. What do you think about the Westminster Dog Show or those high-end, high-level dog shows?
You know, I have issues with it because the conformation standards, the breeding standards, are valuing the exterior characteristics of the animal, like the face of a pug or the length of the dachshund's back. I have no problem with the idea of people loving and lavishing their dogs. We want that. The problem is there has been breeding that has accentuated characteristics in these animals that compromise their health and well-being. They have genetic and hereditary problems that shorten their lives, produce chronic pain and suffering. Mm. We want to work with folks in that world to do the proper breeding so that the animals don't suffer from these congenital problems that they face.
And I mean, there's certain breeds that are having, for instance, trouble breathing because of the way their face has been reconstructed.
Reconstructed through selective breeding. I mean, think about it. You know, dogs came from wolves. Now we've got everything from Chihuahuas to Great Danes. And many of these animals have problems. They are more prone to certain types of cancer. They are more prone to back problems. German Shepherds have, you know, hip dysplasia issues. So the laundry list of these problems is so long. And I think that, again, Westminster, you know, is a celebration of dogs. It's a celebration of the human-animal bond. I love all of that. What I don't love is the idea of breeding for certain characteristics that are going to cause the animal's health problems.
And you sometimes wonder with that sort of round, mushed-in face whether it's that baby face. I mean, as opposed to the long, more pointy face, it's a more adult-looking face.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, again, we shouldn't be designing dogs for our purposes. We should be designing dogs for their health and well-being.
Let me get, looks like Carolyn from Chester Springs to join us on Radio Times. Carolyn, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I have done animal rescue work for 35 years, and I had the opinion that the SPCAs were terrible places because of the fact that they had to euthanize animals. But once I got out onto the streets and started picking up abandoned cats and dogs, I found that euthanasia was much preferable to having an animal go to a family where they would be abandoned to the streets with no water, no food, and no shelter, to struggle until they have a slow, painful death. Mm-hmm. Euthanasia is peaceful and quick. And no-kill shelters make us think that the SPCA is better now because they don't euthanize, but at the cost of the animal going to a home where they shouldn't be. The Pennsylvania SPCA has adoption days where they will give you a dog for a dollar or two kittens for a dollar. You know, what they do little or no screening. And I've picked up abandoned cats with microchips from the Pennsylvania SPCA. And education is what's needed here to teach children the right way to take care of children. And the other big problem is what is the Humane Society doing to reach college students, which really shocked me when I heard how many college students abandon their pets every year when the spring semester is over.
Well, Carolyn, I appreciate the call. She's raised several good points.
Yeah, she has. You know, this is an important issue of striking the balance between moving animals out and giving them a chance. Because, you know, I don't think anyone should want to see euthanasia of a healthy and treatable animal. They have their lives. They should be allowed to live them out. We obviously don't want to hand out animals to people unsuited to care for them. So there are adoption screening procedures that almost every reputable rescue group or shelter has. However, they should not be so strict that, therefore, we're absolutely positively certain that this is going to be the greatest place for the animal for the rest of their lives. We can become too strict on that side. So we have to find that proper balance. Euthanasia is, in my opinion, of a healthy animal, a moral problem. That doesn't mean that the institutions that are euthanizing are guilty of anything, because they are not the only deciders. they are faced with a terrible glut of animals, and they are picking the least bad of the options that exist. We should be driving toward a no-kill nation because we're all involved, not just the shelter, the rescue group, because every one of us is making the right choices, that we shutter the puppy mills, that we are bringing animals into our lives for all the right reasons. We know we can care for them properly. And I tell you, I go back to our Pets for Life program here in Philadelphia. The people in some of these zip codes where people are economically struggling, they love their animals. It's so much an issue of the services that are available to them, and we're helping provide that so we can reinforce the bond and allow these folks to act on their love of their animals. It's just a beautiful thing to see.
And is she right about students or college students who will get a puppy or a kitten and then what, they go home for the summer and leave the animals behind?
Sometimes we see that. She is right about that, and we are trying to educate everybody. I mean, we've got a full docket at the Humane Society. You think about the incredible array of issues that we're confronting. I mean, we're one group. We are firing on all pistons every day, but there are so many unattended issues. There are so many demographic groups that we would love to, you know, target more, you know, more closely. You know, this is why I want people to become members of the Humane Society of the U.S. As we get more support, then we can do more of these programs. I mean, it's just not a self-executing social movement. We need people to get behind us.
An email from Catherine. She says, what about zoos? There have been several tiger attacks of zookeepers recently. Could caged animals in zoos be more humanely kept? Are zoos facing this issue realistically? Will zoos ever disappear?
You know, that's another great question. You know, in the mid-70s, Parade magazine, an old friend of mine did an expose of the worst zoos in America.
Ugh.
And since that time, so many zoos are doing a better job. Now, that's not going to satisfy, you know, people who just want the animals in the wild or just want animals who were rescued and have no other option. But we draw a big distinction between the 220 or so accredited zoos and aquariums and the 2,000 roadside zoos. There are these menageries on the side of the road all over the United States where animals are poorly cared for, denied vet care. The people running the operations have no business caring for these animals. They don't have enough resources. So we're focused on that. I do think, you know, we've been critics of some zoos and certain exhibits, and that dialogue and discussion will continue. But we're united in not wanting these roadside zoos and not wanting private citizens to get wild animals as pets. People have tigers as pets. They have primates as pets. They have anacondas. They've got, you know, all sorts of large constricting snakes. It almost never turns out well for these animals. And then our community, which has so many different organizations to help animals in crisis, is burdened with having these animals at some enormous expense. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars collectively.
And isn't the Everglades like filled with these gigantic
anacondas? Yeah, they were escapees from the pet trade. There was a hurricane. They escaped. And now Burmese pythons are inhabiting South Florida, and they are There are some studies that show in certain transect surveys, 99% of the small mammals are gone. The bobcats,
because they've been
eaten by these non-native species. So the exotic animal trade has so many destructive practices: humane, ecological, human safety. People get hurt by these animals. Why do they have them in their backyard or basement? There are more tigers in the United States in private hands than there are tigers in the wild.
So someone might have a tiger in their basement?
Yeah, if a state doesn't have a prohibition, there are a number of states that have no prohibitions on this. We're fighting to address it in every state.
An email from David Cantor. He always writes to us when we talk about animals. He says, I'm among the very longtime animal advocates who find the anti-cruelty standard too low to enable non-human animals to lead fulfilling lives they deserve. For instance, shouldn't we lead the world away from having pet industries altogether, since humans are not innately entitled to non-human animals, even to love them? He's basically saying no one should have pets. Sounds like animals should just sort of live in the wild. We'll do our lives, and we don't need to interact with each other.
Well,
I'm overstating that.
Yeah,
David.
That. Yeah, David is an old friend, and I think he and I disagree on this one point. We agree on a lot. I think the human-animal bond is so important, and I think that we can properly care for them, and they enrich our lives, and we give a good life to the animals. So I'm for companion animals in our lives. We just need to be responsible caretakers and get the animals from the proper places.
This is something you mentioned in your book about Japan and whaling. You call Japan really an outlaw nation. They're not recognizing or abiding by the International Court of Justice.
Yes, yes. Japan is a party to a United Nations treaty called the International Whaling Commission, and Australia, at the urging of the Humane Society of the United States and our international division, HSI, Australia sued Japan under the International Court of Justice, ruled in our favor and in Australia's favor. Japan honored the ruling for a year, and then they said, oh, well, we're just going to go back to commercial whaling. There are three nations in the world that are still whaling. Of 200 nations in the world, Japan is number one. What reason do we have to kill these whales? The largest animals who have ever lived on the planet. Young people in Japan don't want to eat whale meat. They've got storehouse freezers full of whale meat in Japan, yet they're still doing it. I mean, it's in defiance of everything you think of. And just yesterday, SeaWorld, with the Humane Society of the U.S., again, our longtime adversary, new ally, took ads in many major papers throughout the country calling on the United States to impose sanctions on Japan for its criminal, illegal global whaling program.
Let me see what Meg from Westchester has to say. Meg, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Hi, Wayne. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an 18-year-old who's college-bound, and she has been a vegan now for almost a year, and she's leading our very meat and potato family into that area. Which
how's that going, and, Meg?
yeah, and it's been wonderful, and she's so passionate about it. My question, Wayne, is this. She wants to take this into her academic pursuit. She is looking at environmental sciences, but it's hard to focus. It touches on so many things, agriculture, animal, you know, is it nutrition, is it science? Can you give some sort of guidance or some suggestions on, because it's young people that are, and she's not alone.
Sure,
There's lots of friends.
Yeah, Meg, thanks for the call.
Yeah, so many young people bring us wonderful ideas, don't they? Their idealism and we learn from them. It's so great. Obviously all of us should be making, conscious choices in our lives. In this case, she's so passionate about the issue, she wants to develop a career. You can come at it from many angles. As you indicate, there's an animal protection angle and working with groups like HSUS. There's an environmental angle because of the waste issues, the greenhouse gas emissions. Animal ag is a huge contributor to greenhouse gases and warming the planet. There's the nutrition side because a lot of people worry if you eat just plant-based foods, you're going to get healthy. So much evidence shows that you'll be healthier if you do it. So, yes, I mean, please contact us at the Humane Society. We've got a whole department. We've got folks who work in all of these realms, and we'd love to talk with her at some point.
Your book is about some of these successes. As you said, you're not doing a victory dance yet. What's the issue that has consumed you the most recently?
Well, we're really ending the era of extreme confinement of animals in agriculture. We announced earlier this month that Walmart, which sells 25% of all groceries in the U.S., is phasing out its purchase of eggs from farms that confine the hens in these small cages. They're called battery cages, six or eight birds in a small cage. They can't turn around. They're immobilized. It'd be like six or eight of us, Marty, in a small elevator, never getting out. I mean, this is shameful behavior that we exhibit in conventional agriculture when it comes to this confinement. So now we've run the table with 120 of the biggest brand names in food. That's exciting. We're going to focus on some of the poultry issues, the meat birds. They're growing so fast. They have all sorts of problems. I'm also focused on the South Korean dog issue. I want to also end horse slaughter in North America. We're slaughtering 140,000 American horses, mainly by shipping them to Canada and Mexico. For meat, for export to Europe and Asia. We've got a global campaign. We're now active through our Humane Society International in 50 countries. We're going to 75.
Well, Wayne Pacelli, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Head of the Humane Society of the United States, author of The Humane Economy, Animal Protection 2.0, How Innovators and Enlightened Consumers Are Transforming the Lives of Animals. And he'll be running over to the Free Library of Philadelphia to be there to talk some more. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.